Imagine for a second just outlasting the dinosaurs, like actually surviving asteroid strikes, shifting continents, multiple global ice ages over the course of 150 million years.
It's almost impossible to really conceptualize that kind of timeline.
It really is. But then imagine surviving all of that, only to be pushed to the absolute brink of extinction today by, a discarded plastic bag or a bright porch light.
Yeah, it's a stark contrast.
That is the staggering reality we are exploring today with you. We are pulling from the Red Sea Creatures Marine Database to do a deep dive into the profile of World Sea Turtle Day.
And the core paradox of this source material is honestly kind of difficult to wrap your head around.
Right, because we are looking at a clade of animals that are, by biological definition, the ultimate evolutionary survivors. I mean, they mastered the art of survival on a geological timescale.
But their architecture is failing them in the modern era. It's a profound evolutionary trap, really. Well, you have this highly specialized ancient biological system that navigated the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event, the asteroid, with relative ease. But the mechanisms that allowed them to survive raw, violent natural history are now the exact traits making them so vulnerable.
So they didn't like become physically weaker over time.
Oh, not at all. It's just that the environment has shifted at a speed that completely outpaces their capacity for evolutionary adaptation.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to grasp how a globally distributed lineage goes from outliving a T-Rex to facing systemic collapse, we have to look at the remaining architecture of that lineage.
Right, we're not talking about a massive, highly diversified family tree anymore.
Exactly. The database highlights that there are exactly seven distinct species of sea turtles left on the planet. Just seven.
Just seven.
You've got the green, the hawksbill, the Kemp's Ridley, the leatherback, the loggerhead, the olive ridley, and the flatback.
And out of those seven, there's a really fascinating geographical quirk. The flatback is the sole outlier. It restricts itself exclusively to the Western Indo-Pacific.
Which means the other six?
Yeah, the other six species utilize U.S. waters
Yeah.
at various stages of their complex life cycles.
Which puts them right in the crosshairs,
Right.
right? That makes their migratory corridors heavily intersected by some of the busiest commercial maritime traffic in the world.
It does. And that translates directly to their current status on the IUCN Red List.
It's pretty grim. Six of those seven remaining species are classified as vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered.
We are genuinely looking at the potential truncation of a 150 million year old bloodline.
But the source material makes a really strong point to emphasize that losing these seven species isn't just, a blow to global biodiversity. It's a structural threat to the ocean's biological pump.
What's fascinating here is the precise ecological utility they provide. I mean, they are foundational load bearers for marine habitats.
Give me an example of that.
Well, take the green sea turtle, for instance. They are one of the very few large herbivores in the ocean, and their primary function is grazing on seagrass beds.
Oh.
But it's the way they graze that matters. By cropping the seagrass just above the root, they prevent the blades from growing too long, because if they get too long, they shade themselves out and start rotting.
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so that constant grazing actually increases the productivity and nutrient density of the seagrass. And that seagrass acts as a massive carbon sink. Plus, it's a critical nursery for countless species of commercially viable fish.
And if you remove that grazing pressure, those seagrass beds essentially suffocate themselves, rot, and create these localized anoxic dead zones.
Exactly. And then, you have species like the leatherback, which specialize in eating jellyfish.
Right. And without leatherbacks maintaining that predatory pressure, jellyfish populations just explode.
And since jellyfish consume the larval stages of fish, a booming jelly population can trigger the collapse of entire regional fisheries.
It is such a tightly woven trophic cascade. They aren't just swimming through the ecosystem, they are actively engineering and maintaining its baseline stability. The outline of this crisis reminds me of an engineering concept.
Oh, yeah. Like what?
Think of a piece of vintage technology, like an Apollo-era spacecraft. The hardware was built so robustly that it could survive the extreme radiation of deep space, micrometeorite impacts, the brutal thermal shock of atmospheric reentry.
It's over-engineered for physical extremes.
Exactly. It's virtually indestructible under the physical laws it was designed for. But if you were to take that same bulletproof hardware and suddenly force it to run a modern corrupted software update, the entire navigation system just crashes.
That is a great way to put it.
The hardware is still perfect, but the operating environment changed the rules entirely.
That perfectly isolates the conflict. The sea turtles' biological hardware, like their migratory endurance, their armor, their metabolic efficiency, is flawless.
Right.
But the external cues they rely on, the software of their environment, has been completely rewritten by anthropogenic interference, by us.
Which really forces us to look at the timeline of how we discovered this critical hardware failure.
Yeah.
And that brings us to June 16th.
World Sea Turtle Day.
Yes, World Sea Turtle Day. And that specific date is tied directly to the birth of Dr. Archie Carr in 1909. The scientific community basically recognizes him as the father of sea turtle biology.
He's a towering figure in conservation.
But I'm looking at this timeline, and there is a staggering disproportion here.
What do you mean?
Well, we have a clade thriving entirely independently for millions of years. And then abruptly, their survival hinges on one zoologist in the mid-20th century frantically pulling the emergency brake. How wild is it that a creature thriving that long suddenly needed one guy to sound the alarm just to keep them from disappearing?
It is wild.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that prior to Dr. Carr's work in the 1950s and 60s, marine biology largely viewed sea turtles through a really highly localized lens.
Like they only cared about the turtles on their own beaches.
Essentially, yes. They were seen as just an endless fishery resource. If a population vanished from a specific beach in the Caribbean, local authorities just assumed, oh, they moved somewhere else.
They had no concept of the big picture.
Right. Carr was the one who pioneered the extensive flipper tagging programs that proved migratory connectivity. He was the one who demonstrated that a turtle nesting in Costa Rica might actually be foraging off the coast of Brazil.
He proved they were shared global citizens.
Exactly.
Meaning localized protection was entirely useless if they were just going to be slaughtered in international waters or harvested on a completely different continent.
Precisely. He elevated the issue from a niche scientific curiosity to a massive geopolitical conservation mandate.
He showed everyone that you need international cooperation.
Yes. He mapped out the fact that their life cycle requires traversing multiple sovereign territories, meaning any successful protection framework had to be an international synchronized effort.
So Dr. Carr builds the framework, but let's look at what that framework is actually defending against today. The Red Sea Creatures database outlines this gauntlet of modern threats, and the sheer mechanical efficiency of these threats is brutal.
It's overwhelmingly human-caused.
Yeah. The leading cause of mortality is bycatch. Specifically, entanglement in commercial fishing gear, like gill nets and long lines.
And knowing the biology of a marine reptile, you know, entanglement isn't just an inconvenience. It is a rapid physiological countdown.
Because they have to surface to breathe?
Right. It is an agonizing mechanism of death. While a resting sea turtle can hold its breath for hours by slowing its heart rate and conserving oxygen, a turtle caught in a trawl net is in a state of absolute panic.
By fighting the net.
Yes, and that sheer physical exertion burns through their oxygen reserves exponentially faster, leading to this massive buildup of lactic acid in their bloodstream. They become acutely hypoxic and drown, often within less than an hour of being entangled.
It's awful, and even if they manage to navigate the commercial fishing corridors, they still have to successfully reproduce, which brings us to habitat destruction.
This is where that biological software glitch really shows up.
Yeah, these animals are highly philopatric, which means they possess an internal magnetic compass that guides them back to the exact coastal regions where they were born decades earlier just to lay their own eggs.
It's an incredible navigational feat.
It is. But today, those ancient nesting coordinates are heavily armored with seawalls, or they're paved over by resorts, or just rapidly eroding due to rising sea levels.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you see how human development directly disrupts an evolutionary rhythm that has worked flawlessly for millions of years.
It just severs their reproductive cycle entirely.
Completely. A female turtle might migrate thousands of miles to reach her natal beach, only to find a concrete retaining wall right where the dunes used to be.
The evolutionary programming that guided her flawlessly across entire oceans suddenly leads her to a dead end.
Right. And she may end up dropping her eggs in the ocean or in the surf zone, where they'll just immediately drown.
And then you add on to that the continued pressure of black market poaching for their shells and meat, plus the pervasive hazard of marine debris.
The plastics problem is severe.
Yeah, the database notes that leatherbacks frequently mistake suspended plastic bags for their primary food source, jellyfish.
Because a floating plastic bag looks exactly like a jellyfish to them.
Right. And the plastic causes these gastrointestinal blockages that lead to slow starvation.
But the database also brings up a threat that operates on a completely invisible molecular level, and it has to do with climate change altering the thermodynamics of the nesting beaches.
Oh, the TSD, temperature-dependent sex determination.
Exactly. Unlike mammals, sea turtles do not possess distinct X and Y sex chromosomes that lock in the biological sex of the offspring at the moment of fertilization.
Right, so it's not determined at conception.
No. Instead, the sex of the hatchling is dictated entirely by the ambient temperature of the sand that's incubating the clutch during the middle third of its development.
The mechanism behind this is wild. It relies heavily on an enzyme called aromatase.
Yes, the thermal trigger.
Yeah, when the sand temperature rises above a certain pivotal threshold, usually around 85 degrees Fahrenheit or about 29 degrees Celsius, that thermal energy triggers the aromatase enzyme to convert the embryo's testosterone into estrogen.
Warmer sand activates the aromatase, which results in female hatchlings. Cooler sand limits that conversion, resulting in males.
And from an evolutionary standpoint, this probably provided a nice population buffer. Yeah. But with the rapid, unnatural elevation of global temperatures today, the system is breaking down.
It's completely skewed now. We are seeing major nesting beaches, particularly in places like Australia and Florida, churning out clutches that are 99% female.
99%? I mean, you don't need a degree in population dynamics to see the terminal trajectory there.
Without enough males in the breeding population, fertilization rates plummet.
And the population inevitably crashes, regardless of how many nesting females you have.
It is the silent demographic collapse occurring beneath the sand before the turtles even hatch.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Even if a hatchling successfully develops, you know, it manages to hatch and break out of its shell, it faces an entirely different vulnerability, one that ties perfectly back to our corrupted software analogy.
The artificial lighting.
Yes. The database heavily emphasizes the danger of artificial coastal lighting. For millions of years, the hatchling's primary navigational tool when they emerge from the nest at night has been a process called seafinding.
They are phototactic.
Exactly. They are hardwired to move toward the brightest, most open horizon, which historically was always the ambient light of the moon and stars reflecting off the surface of the ocean.
The visual spectrum they rely on is incredibly specific. The ocean provides this wide, low-level illumination, while the dark silhouette of the dunes behind them creates a stark visual contrast.
And that contrast is the directional beacon that pulls them to the water.
Right.
But then, you know, we line the coasts with streetlights, hotel floodlights, boardwalks. It is essentially the equivalent of jamming an airplane's automated navigational instruments with a false radio beacon.
It really is.
The hatchlings emerge, their biological instruments lock onto the overwhelming artificial glare from the land, and they turn completely away from the ocean. They crawl into streets, fall into storm drains, or simply exhaust themselves until the sun comes up and they succumb to dehydration or predators.
It highlights the extreme fragility of their adaptation. They aren't making a conscious choice to crawl toward the streetlights. They are simply executing a hardwired command that worked without fail for 150 million years until human engineering polluted their visual landscape.
That is a staggering gauntlet to run.
It really is a gauntlet.
But thankfully, the profile from Red Sea creatures pivots from the sheer scale of the threats to the mechanics of our intervention. Because we recognize the hardware failure we've caused, we are actively engineering survival tactics.
And one of the most critical structural protections currently implemented is the Turtle Excluder Device, or TED.
TEDs are just a brilliant application of hydrodynamic engineering. They directly address that massive bycatch mortality we discussed earlier.
Yeah, a TED is essentially a rigid metal grid integrated into the funnel of a commercial trawl net. The vertical bars of the grid are spaced wide enough to allow the targeted catch, like shrimp or smaller fish, to pass through into the back of the net.
But when a 400-pound loggerhead gets swept into the trawl, it is physically too large to pass through that grid.
Right. And the water pressure inside the moving net forces the turtle to slide up or down along the angle of those bars, directly toward a specialized escape flap cut into the netting.
So the turtle's own mass basically forces the flap open, ejecting it from the trawl while the commercial catch remains secured inside.
It is an elegant solution because it relies entirely on the physical dimensions of the animal. It doesn't require active monitoring from the fishing crew.
And when implemented correctly, TEDs reduce sea turtle bycatch mortality by up to 97% in those fisheries.
97%, that is huge.
It's a massive mitigation of the primary threat. And we are seeing similar mitigation in local policy through strict coastal lighting ordinances, too. In heavily populated nesting areas, legislation now mandates the use of turtle-safe lighting during the nesting season. And this isn't just about, you know, dimming the lights. It involves actual wavelength filtering.
Right, because sea turtles are highly sensitive to the short, visible wavelengths of light. The bright whites, blues, and greens.
So what do they do instead?
By mandating the use of long wavelength lighting, specifically deep red or amber LEDs, and shielding the fixtures so the light points downward, coastal communities can maintain visibility for humans while rendering the light practically invisible to the nesting mothers and the emerging hatchlings.
That is so smart. Then you layer on the overarching legal armor of the Endangered Species Act, which provides rigorous federal-level oversight for critical marine habitats.
Making it a federal crime to harass the animals or destroy their nesting sites.
It creates a multi-jurisdictional safety net. You have the mechanical engineering of the TEDs in the open ocean, the localized civic ordinances managing the beach lighting, and the federal law providing punitive enforcement.
But the source material is adamant that this isn't an issue localized just to industrial fisheries or coastal developers.
No, there are granular individual actions recommended for you, the listener. Simple behavioral shifts.
Like aggressively reducing single-use plastic consumption to choke off the supply of marine debris.
Or ensuring deep coastal waste disposal. So raccoons and foxes, whose populations artificially inflate around human trash, aren't drawn to the beaches where they inevitably predate on turtle nests.
And something as seemingly benign as a beach bonfire.
Oh yeah, the bonfires.
The heat signature from a bonfire can lethally alter the incubation temperature of nests buried below it. And the chaotic, flickering light acts as an intense local jamming signal for any hatchlings trying to run their sea-finding programming.
So what does this all mean? When you zoom out, the defense strategy is entirely holistic. You have international maritime law operating in tandem with the individual decision to just skip a bonfire or refuse a plastic straw.
Every single action represents a necessary patch in the software update designed to pull these animals out of the modern gauntlet.
Yeah.
This raises an important question, though, for you, the listener. What stands out to you about how easily everyday human habits intersect with ancient marine biology?
It's a heavy thought.
It is. It is incredibly easy to view yourself as isolated from the broader ecological machine when you live in a modern urban environment. But the reality presented here is that a synthetic bag dropped in a parking lot or an unshielded bulb on a coastal balcony can act as the terminal mechanism for an animal lineage older than the continents in their current configuration.
It's an intense realization of our global footprint. And as we synthesize the data from this deep dive, that really is the core takeaway.
That we're all connected to it.
Exactly. The survival of sea turtles isn't just a nostalgic conservation effort. It is an ecological necessity for the equilibrium of the oceans.
But beyond the trophic cascades and the biodiversity metrics, there is something deeply resonant about their biology.
Yeah. They continue to navigate ocean currents and drag themselves up onto rapidly degrading beaches, instinctively executing a survival strategy against insurmountable odds.
Their behavioral persistence is remarkable. I mean, they don't possess the capacity to understand the seawalls or the trawl nets. They simply endure. They just respond to the ancient rhythm of their programming.
The resilience of the biological hardware is undeniable.
It really is.
And because they lack the ability to adapt to the artificial hazards we've constructed, the burden of adaptation falls entirely on us.
We engineered the environment that is breaking them. We possess the capacity to engineer the solutions.
So as June 16th approaches, take a moment to track the hashtag World Sea Turtle Day. Engage with the research, understand the mechanics of the ocean's biological pump, and recognize the legacy of Dr. Archie Carr, who transformed localized observation into a massive global defense network.
The tools for their preservation are well established. It is simply a matter of sustained collective execution.
Well said. And as you go about the rest of your day, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. We began by acknowledging the ultimate evolutionary paradox of the sea turtle. Think about the sheer scale of that contradiction.
It's immense.
If a biological system is robust enough to survive the literal asteroid impact that vaporized the dinosaurs, but fragile enough to be systematically dismantled by a floating grocery bag and an artificial porch light, what does that reveal about the sheer terrifying speed of human impact compared to the slow, steady march of natural evolution?
It truly redefines our understanding of what constitutes an extinction-level event.
It really does. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.